This is WDET, your source for news, music, and culture in Detroit. Please protect your source for on-demand programs, podcasts, and radio programs that you can experience whenever and wherever you choose. Make a gift today at WDET.org.
Hi, I'm Ann DeLisi. Welcome to Essential Conversations. In this episode, I talk with official White House photographer for all 8 years of the Obama administration, Pete Souza. During that time, he shot 1.9 million photos, including the Hair Like Mine photo that depicts a little boy touching President Obama's head. We talk about that, life in the White House, and his favorite day in that historic place. Here's my conversation with Pete Souza.
I mean, I had the unique advantage of two things. One, I was a White House photographer during the Reagan administration, so I knew how the job should be done. Now, I didn't know Reagan that well. I wasn't his chief photographer, but I knew how the White House worked. And then two, I met Barack Obama when he was elected to the Senate in 2004, and for the Chicago Tribune, spent a lot of time with him. So he got to know me. We developed a professional relationship. But he also saw how I worked in a way that didn't interfere with what he was doing. So that by the time he was elected to the presidency, I already knew him for 4 years. So that was a huge advantage to having already, I already knew the guy, and I already knew how the White House worked. And I think that's why, you know, I had some success in really truly documenting his presidency for history. You know, he was a unique guy. He understood the value of documenting what he did, and he trusted me. And that's not true with every administration.
When you were offered the job, your criteria was what? Complete access?
Access, just access. And I remember Robert Gibbs, who, in addition to being his incoming press secretary, was really one of his closest aides. And so he was the emissary, as I call it, that reached out to me. And I said to Robert, and I knew Robert pretty well by then, I said, look, I need to have access to everything. And, you know, Robert, all Robert said was, yeah, the president-elect gets it. And that was sort of what I wanted to hear. And then, you know, there's also this period of time when, you know, suddenly you're in the Oval Office and you've got this guy taking pictures of you, like, sort of all day, and like he never goes away, that being me. You know, and that just took a little getting used to, really on both our parts. And then, you know, by the first few months, it was sort of like I was just, you know, I was always there. Nobody really paid attention to me when stuff was going on, you know, which is how you want it if you're, you know, trying to capture these candid moments.
Let's talk about the logistics, like things that people might not think about. So you would drive up to the White House and go through the gate and park and walk in and go to the Oval Office. How did that kind of procedural stuff work?
Yeah, so I would drive to the White House every morning, get there around 8, park just outside, inside the secure area, but outside the White House complex, per se. So I'd have to still go through one security check in person. And then I'd walk up to the West Wing, which is, when you see pictures of the White House, it's the wing on the west side where the Oval Office is and the Cabinet Room. And I had a little cubbyhole office in the ground floor of the West Wing that used to be the White House barbershop. The mirrors are still there and everything. And then President Obama would usually come downstairs from the residence, which was on the second floor of the White House. Actually, I guess depends if it's the third floor of the White House. There's the ground floor, the first floor, which is the state floor, and then the private residence is on the next floor. So he would come downstairs usually around 9:30, and I would be outside the Oval Office waiting for him to come in. And then, you know, the Cliff Notes version of what I did every day is then I'd just tag along with him for the rest of the day till he went home at night. That was basically my job for 8 years, 7 days a week sometimes, not 24 hours a day, but, you know, 12 hours a day.
So you got to be friends with him. and you were close to him, and you saw him making decisions. You saw him when he was happy and during those times that were very difficult. Were there any times when he said to you, you can't photograph this or you have to leave?
No, but the, you know, I had a pretty good, I call myself a seasoned photographer, right? It sounds better than old. I've experienced a lot of things, and I've photographed a lot of people, and I think I have pretty good intuition. And so, you know, I had a good sense of, you know, when he needed some space. And it usually involved if he was having a one-on-one meeting with someone, because I knew for those one-on-one meetings that, you know, he wanted to have a private conversation. And he didn't object to me photographing, but I wouldn't necessarily stay the entire meeting. And that was like not him saying anything to me. That was just, you know, I just sort of kind of feel it out, right? And then, you know, the other times where I was really cognizant of his space is when he was with one of his daughters. And there's a picture in the book of him and Malia sitting on the swing set right outside the Oval Office. And it's a pretty intimate picture. They're having this, you know, father-daughter conversation about what was going on with Malia at school that day. You know, I don't know what they were talking about exactly. And I made a few pictures. I made, you know, made sure I got a really good picture because it was just, you know, an incredible, intimate, candid scene. But then I just slowly, once I got my pictures, I just totally backed away and let him have, you know, private time with his daughter. And again, that's enough. He never said this to me. It's just a matter of, you can sort of feel.
You were sensitive.
Or sensitive. You gotta feel it out.
Another logistical question for you. How many cameras would you carry?
I carry two cameras, one usually with a wide-angle lens on it and one with a telephoto lens on it. And then I would usually have another lens in a pouch on my belt. That's inside the White House. I travel very lightly, and, you know, I tried to keep my equipment to a minimum.
Because you didn't, unlike other photographers, you couldn't have an assistant with you, so you were a one-man show. But you also had a remote camera that you would use, and that last shot of President Obama leaving the White House was done with a remote camera,
right?
It is
not a remote camera, actually.
What is it?
It was I was standing on a ladder. So this is, it's one of the few times. So this is a picture on January 20th. He's in the Oval Office that morning for the last time, and he's leaving the Oval Office for the last time as president. So I actually thought about this beforehand, which I never did in terms of, I was always reacting to whatever took place. That was, you know, sort of the way I approached it, where I wasn't trying to, like, you know, determine ahead of time what kind of picture I was going to make. Well, this one was different because I knew which door he was going to walk out of. And I knew, you know, that it was going to be that morning. And I went to one of my GSA friends. This is the General Services Administration that takes care of all the government buildings. I said, do you guys have like an 8-foot ladder, you know, in the West Wing somewhere? And they did. So I said, can you like set it up for me in the Oval Office? And I showed him exactly where. I said, probably around 10 o'clock, you know, because I knew about what time he was coming to the office. And so that's how that picture came about. So I sort of, that one was one I sort of preconceived in my mind because I knew which door he was going to walk out of ahead of time. And I knew I wanted to get with a wide-angle lens up high, showing as much as the Oval Office as I could.
So you had to always be aware of your physical presence in a room, or certainly in the Oval Office, of what, how you were going to get your best shots. Talk about that process of being in there, and I guess as different people come in, the dynamic of the room changes. Your space where you situate yourself has to change. Talk about what that was like on a daily basis, to always be mindful of, I got to get the best shot, and this is a changing room all the time.
Well, I mean, actually, there are times when it wasn't a changing room, and those were the hardest times, because if people are sitting in the chairs in front of the fireplace and the other people are sitting on the sofas, That doesn't change. It's sort of like people are. So, you know, it was kind of a challenge in some of these meetings to make an interesting picture. I mean, I always found that usually the most interesting pictures would happen, you know, before the meeting starts or when the meeting breaks up, where you don't know where people are going to go. And the dynamics completely change, where some people are seated, some are standing. You know, it's different. I actually would always be on the lookout for those little, and you might not have very long time where there's a picture to be made. But you know, you're just always on the lookout for something that's going to work, whether it be, you know, the interaction between people or. You know, throughout the year, the Oval Office changes in terms of the light. So in the winter, the sun is lower, more sunlight streams into the Oval Office, especially when the leaves fall off the trees. So, you know, that was the other component in the Oval Office, is the light always changed.
In your entire time photographing President Obama, you say in your book that you took 2 million photos in 8 years.
Yeah.
So during your time, you took 2 million photos in 8 years. So at the end of each day, you would have shot photos all day long. What would happen to the photos? Would they get handed off to somebody else? Would you have to look through what you shot and determine what was you were going to keep, what wasn't worth keeping after the photos were shot? What was the process after that?
Well, first, we kept every photo. We had to, legally. In 1974, Congress passed the Presidential Records Act as a result of Watergate, and including in the documents that every White House had to maintain was the word photographs. So we were not allowed to delete any photographs. So every photograph was saved. I had a photo editor who would go through my pictures throughout the day. And we would respond to if, for instance, the White House website needed a picture from this meeting, or if, you know, NBC was doing a story on this aide and we needed a photo. And so they would do initial edits on the day's photos. I would look at every photo that was going to be made public, because I was, in addition to being the chief photographer, I was the head of the office. And I needed to, I was more aware of everything that was going on in a sense that, you know, I didn't want a photo editor to make the final decision on which picture was going to go out. If there was blame to be had, it needed to be on me. So I did look at every final photo that went out. But most of the work in terms of the day-to-day editing was done by a photo editor.
And you decided what photos would be hung on the walls.
Yeah, again, with the help of a photo editor, yes. Yeah.
How often would those change?
So what you're referring to, just so your listeners know, we would hang these, what we call jumbos, on the mostly on the ground floor of the West Wing. It's a tradition that dates back to Nixon, that the White House Photography Office would hang these photos. So we had these 20 by 30 frames, and we would just switch out the photos. Like we used the same frames for 8 years, and we'd make these big prints, mount them on foam core, and then just pop them in there. So we would try to change out a few every week. We weren't always caught up on mostly probably because of me, but we would try to change out a few every week, and then there were a few that stayed up longer than others because the staff just, like, loved them.
And those included the Hair Like Mine photo?
Yeah, so there's a picture that's become known as Hair Like Mine. It's a young boy, Jacob Philadelphia, and he had come to the Oval Office with his family for a farewell photo for his dad, who was leaving the administration. And after we did the photo of them standing in front of the desk with the president, Jacob, the five-year-old kid, asked the president that, actually it was more like a statement, that his friends had told him that his hair cut was just like the president's. Here's this five-year-old African-American kid. And the president just leans down, and Jacob touches his head, feels his head. I got like one frame of it. It happened so fast, you know, didn't know it was going to happen. You know, and the picture resonated with a lot of people, I think, because you had, you know, this kid touching the head of the president of the United States who looked like him, one. But two, it told you something about Barack Obama that, you know, at the behest of a five-year-old, you'd go ahead and bend over and let him touch your head, that, you know, he didn't really take himself that seriously. So the picture hung for a long time. And I think it was going on like 3 years, and a New York Times reporter noticed it and decided to write a story about it and interviewed me, went and interviewed the family, interviewed Jacob. And that just brought all kinds of more attention to the photograph when the New York Times, you know, ran this story that resonated with a lot of people. And then probably around, I don't know, the 5 or 6 year mark, I was like, okay, we got to take this picture down. So I took the picture down. And the next day, I had three different senior staff members walk into my office, all individually. It wasn't planned. And they said they begged me to put the picture back up because they could give their family and friends tours at night of the West Wing. You get to peek inside the Oval Office, the cabinet room. But you'd also see these cool pictures hanging on the wall. And the staff liked to stop in front of this picture and tell the story. So back up it went, and it stayed up until January 19th, when I had to take all the photos down. Yeah,
that must have been a hard day.
That was a hard day. I think it was, the funny thing about that day was that I waited till the last possible minute. All my staff had been already what we called outboarded. I was like the only one left in my office, so I had to do it myself. But I didn't want to take him down earlier than the 19th because I thought it might psychologically be problematic. So I waited till the late afternoon of the 19th, and I think it kind of shocked people when they saw these blank frames hanging throughout the White House.
So during your time, you were privy to a lot of sensitive information. I would assume being in the room, knowing things that were going, that knowing about things before the American people would know them, that they were coming.
Yeah.
How did you feel when you were in there? Your job was to photograph it and document history, but you were still taking in a lot of information.
Yeah, but so were the people in the room. You know what I mean? It wasn't just me. It was all these, you know, 8 or 10 or 20 people that were privy to the same information, and they're privy to the paperwork that I'm not privy to. And I'm in there to photograph, so I'm like, I got a lot of things to worry about: composition, making sure I'm anticipating the, you know, when to click the shutter, what my f-stop and shutter speed is, all those things. So I'm getting a sense of what's going on. I mean, one thing I can talk about is, you know, we normalized relations with Cuba. That was a huge deal. Well, they had been working on it for a year, and I was in probably, I don't know, 10 or more meetings where they were talking about this. So I knew it was coming for like a year. And, you know, and those are the kind of things that, you know, eventually become known publicly. But like while they're trying to piece this together, you know, that's when, you know, I'm having to not say anything to anybody, including, you know, even my own family.
Right.
But you know what? That was never a problem for me. Not to say anything.
Coming up next, Pete Souza talks about being in the room with the most powerful people in our country the night they captured Osama bin Laden. Hi, I'm Ann DeLisi with the conclusion of my conversation with official White House photographer Pete Souza.
Well, that would bring us to one of your most famous photographs, and that was the night that they went and got bin Laden. And you were in the Situation Room and took that iconic photo. In your book, you talk about having to determine where in the room you were going to put yourself, because it's not a very big space, right? How far ahead did you know that you were going to have to be there to photograph that?
Well, I mean, I knew like about a week before. I didn't know all the details of it. I knew a week before that, you know, this was going down on Sunday. Now, one of the things, the Situation Room is now a complex of three conference rooms. So there's the big conference room, which is the President of the United States, holds all his meetings in. I think it's now called the John F. Kennedy Conference Room because of the Bay of Pigs. Or the Cuban Missile Crisis, I forget which, but they named it after Kennedy because of one of those two situations. But what happened for the bin Laden raid is they had this communications link set up so they could monitor the raid in real time. Now, around 1 o'clock that afternoon, the president had his first meeting in the big situation room, and then the raid was later in the day. It was like 3:30, 4 o'clock, I forget exactly what time. And they didn't know the president wanted to be there while the raid was going on because they just didn't anticipate that. And so they had set it up in this tiny little room that's across from the big conference room. And then when they realized that he wanted to be there at the last minute, they were afraid to switch the link back to the big conference room. They didn't want to lose the connection. So everybody just piled into this tiny little room. So that's where the picture was taken. It's called the Situation Room photo. And technically, it is in the Situation Room, but it's not in the usual conference room that he's in. So it's this really tiny, tiny room. Everybody just like jammed in there. There's people seated, some standing. Dennis McDonough is kneeling, and I had to choose as I came into the room which side of the room to go on. And you know, that was just again instinctual. It'd be interesting if I had pictures from both sides, which side people would say is a better side. I think you know, I wanted to have a clear line of sight of the president, so I think I chose the right side. He did not sit at the head of the table because there was a general sitting there on a laptop communicating directly with Admiral McRaven in Afghanistan, who was running the raid. And instead, the president pulled up a chair next to General Webb. And, you know, we were in there, I think, for like 40 minutes about, and it was pretty tense. And I'll say tonight in my talk that, you know, I think one of the reasons why the faces or there's a lot of anxiety and tension is you got the most powerful people in the federal government all in this room at the same time, and there's not a damn thing they can do to affect the outcome of what's taking place. I mean, their decision was made days and weeks before. Now it's up to these guys on the ground. So can you imagine, you know, you're like hoping and wishing and, you know, did we think of everything? And for 40 minutes, there was this constant anxiety that I think you see in their faces.
Was the monitor they were watching right next to you?
Yeah.
So that's why it looks so incredible, those shots of everybody.
I mean, it was, times, because I like there would never be a reason for me to go into that little conference room ever again, because the president would never go in there. But there were a couple times when I just like peeked my head in there when we were having a meeting in the big conference room, and it's like the room is tinier than it looks in the photo.
Really?
Yeah. It's like I looked at it, and I was like, this room is so tiny. And it's like, and then I was glad, you know, I'm kind of glad I chose the side of the room that I did, because I think if I had chosen the other side, I don't think I would have been able to see the president as well. So
did you realize how much you would be traveling when you said yes to this job?
Yeah, no, I knew.
Yeah.
I knew.
So you were gone much of the time.
No, I mean, I would say that I was gone a lot, but I wasn't gone. You know, if we were to do a domestic trip, unless it was to the West Coast, the most we'd ever be gone would be, you know, one overnight. If it was the West Coast, it'd be longer. Now, some of the foreign trips were longer, but even those were not, you know, we'd do these crazy things where we'd fly overnight, land in wherever, hit the ground running, and then, you know, be in Europe for like 2 or 3 days and then fly back home. And the Asia trips were a little longer. But we were never gone for like 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. It was always, you know, 2 days here, a day here, 5 days here. There was a lot of travel, but it wasn't like constant.
You traveled on Air Force One?
I did.
With the president?
Yeah.
Is it as cool as everybody thinks it is?
Yeah, I mean, I got to say that, you know, from a staff member's perspective, I don't really miss the White House going to the White House every day, but I really miss being on that plane just for the ease of travel because, you know, there's no having to go through security and, you know, if we're doing an overnight trip, your bag magically appears in your room and stuff like that. So I miss all that stuff, and it's all associated with Air Force One.
Some of those photographs from him in other countries are really quite stunning. Seeing him in these other cultures and the response yeah. that these people around the world would have to him.
Well, I mean, he mentions this actually in the foreword, where that a lot of the pictures that I captured were it's not him. It's a picture of the people. Sometimes you see him, sometimes you don't. But I was always trying to capture that. What you talk about, and you know, and he noticed that, because when he would see the pictures hanging on the walls, he would see a lot of times there weren't pictures of him,
or the back of his head or something.
Yeah, yeah, but I was trying to show things from his perspective on how people were reacting. That was one of the favorite things for me to do when we were in these foreign countries.
What was he like to be around on a daily basis, watching him do his job for this country?
I think people have a pretty good sense of what he's like. You can't fake it, right? And especially with social media, we have a pretty good idea of what our presidents are like. Now, I will say that I know him better than most people because I was, you know, always around. And, you know, the one thing that's interesting about the White House photographer, at least when I was there, is that I would see him in all these different components of his life, whether it was in the Situation Room, whether it was at a barbecue with his family, you know, whether it was on Air Force One, you know. So I got to see him in all these different situations. I mean, there's a couple things that maybe don't come across. One, this man was as disciplined a guy as I've ever met. And when I say disciplined, I mean disciplined about work, disciplined about diet, disciplined about exercise. You know, it sort of makes you feel bad when, you know, you see how good he is at this. But, I mean, when I say work, so, for instance, every night he'd go home, have dinner with his family, and then he had an office in the residence. And he'd be in there 4 or 5 hours every night, reading his briefing materials for the next day, looking at action memos, stuff like that. And the next day, when he'd be in these meetings, I knew he had done his homework, because he'd always say to people, if they were trying to decide an issue, he'd say, let's cut to the chase. I've read the memos. I know the issue. You know, what else do you have to offer? And there were probably maybe less than 5 times in 8 years where he'd say something like, we had the state dinner last night, I didn't get bed to 1, so I didn't read the memo. That almost never happened. So that's why I say disciplined about work. I think he probably has a better sense of humor than people realize. He teases people.
Teased you a lot, too.
Teased me a lot. He called me the Azorian for a while because he found out my grandparents were from the Azores.
And about your lizard, right?
About my lizard, about my, you know, I started getting a bald spot in my hair, and, you know, just, but he does that to people he likes, you know, not, and it was always done in good fun, and, you know, and you could actually, believe it or not, occasionally give it back to him.
Really?
But you had to be careful, because he is the President of the United States.
Right.
But I did a few times, you know, just.
Was he self-deprecating? Could he laugh at himself?
Oh, yeah. He laughed at himself all the time. Yeah.
Did he?
Yeah.
That one photo that you shot, which I think is hilarious, of him next to the Easter Bunny.
Yeah, that's one where he laughed at himself.
That's pretty good.
Because I was with him with the first... I was with him when... We hung that one on the wall, and I was with him the first time he saw it, and he just started cracking up.
Yeah, that's pretty great.
Yeah.
This is, I can't help but ask you this question, but you must have some favorites in this bunch that you look at even now and go, that was a really good shot.
For me, it was always about trying to create the best body of work, and it's hard to say this, you know, this is my favorite photo. People ask me this all the time mm-hmm. when I do Q&As after my
right.
talks, and I always like, you know, I always punt, as they say. I'll tell you, one of my favorite days we had this big, huge snowstorm in D.C. Cable TV called it Snowmageddon. And I had to sleep in my office because I was worried I wouldn't be able to get back to the White House the next day because of the snow and the difficulty D.C. seems to have in clearing streets. So I slept in my office, and the next day was a Saturday. And I suspected, because the girls were still pretty young, that at some point he would come outside and play in the snow with them. I didn't know this for sure, but I, you know, it was a pretty educated guess. I knew him pretty well. And then he did. He came outside. They played out in the snow. They were walking over the South Lawn, the Rose Garden. And I have great memories of that day just because it's, you know, I'm the only one out there with him and the two girls running around. And, you know, and he's just being a dad, a goofy dad, you know. And
those
just,
photos are fun to see. So the Secret Service, did he make them crazy? It seems like he would want to, the bears loose, is that what it was called? When he would go out?
Well, he didn't drive them crazy. I think there was one time where they didn't get a heads up that he was going to go for a walk. And they weren't too happy about that. But other than that, no, I mean, it was all done with, you know, usually those things would be planned out to a certain extent where, like, if we were, like, we did these bus tours where the advance team might pick out three or four different spots where they might stop, right? And not tell anybody, but a Secret Service guy would know. And then about an hour before, let's say they decided, let's go to this diner, about an hour before Secret Service an advance team would show up, really low-key, and start, you know, making sure that everything was secure. But it was always better to do it in surprise. Mm-hmm. Like, that's sort of the best security, right? You don't know he's coming.
I'm Ann DeLisi, and you're listening to my interview with official White House photographer and photojournalist Pete Souza about covering the Obama administration for 8 years. So this interview is going along just swimmingly. And we were about, I guess, maybe 35 minutes into it or something like that. And I happened to look down at my digital recorder. I will glance at it to make sure everything's going as it should from time to time. And there was a flashing error message that my SD card was full. Well, I was mortified, of course. And in any other situation, this would be a nightmare. But Mr. Souza was so cool about it that he said, oh, I have an SD card in my bag. Is it the same one that you use? And then we would be able to finish the interview. And so he went to his camera bag and he pulled one out and I tried to use it, but I think it was formatted for a camera instead of using it for audio. So he sat patiently and checked his email while I fired up my laptop. Thank goodness I brought it with me. And I transferred the files that were already recorded, wiped the card clean, and got back to business. And he was just so nice about this little mishap. So anyway, I want to thank him for brushing off my technical issue like it was nothing. So when we got back to it, we ended up talking about music, artists that he likes, Bono's impromptu White House performance, and Paul McCartney singing to Michelle Obama. But first, I asked him what life was like after the White House, and his book was The First Order of Business. So we picked up the conversation there.
I mean, last year was really a book year, just in terms of editing the pictures for the book. And then promoting the book, you know, when it came out in November. So, you know, I was on the road a lot in November, December, January.
It's a little bit different traveling not on Air Force One.
It's a little bit different. This is why I said I miss Air Force One. It's just like commercial travels. Hasn't been as bad as I thought, though, I have to say. You know, so now I'm just trying to figure out the next part of my life. I actually am in the beginning stages of putting together a photo exhibit for 2019-2020 that will be on two presidents, you know, and trying to show what my experience was like with both of them in an exhibit format, which, you know, has been exciting to think about. I want to get back to doing some new photography. I think I have some projects left in me that hopefully in the next few years I'll be able to get done.
Do you still carry a camera with you?
I always have a camera with me. I always have my iPhone. That's one camera. And then I have I have a little camera that I keep in my bag that I always have it with me.
What kind of camera is it?
Well, for a carrying around camera, it's a Fuji X-Pro 2, which is a small mirrorless camera with, the files are really good. If I'm on assignments, I still use my my Canon 5D Mark IVs.
The sales of those are going to go up real fast. Do you take many photos with your iPhone?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I've tried to do with the iPhone is I usually almost always shoot with my iPhone in the square format because it makes me think a little differently than your traditional digital DSLR camera, which, you know, is either horizontal or vertical. But I use the iPhone for square pictures. That's sort of like it makes my brain think a little bit differently. When I was in Italy, I had one day where the printer was not working that day. It was on a weekend, and my wife had gone back home, so I was by myself. So I went to Verona, and for a day, I spent the whole day just running around doing street photography with my iPhone, shooting square format. And I had a blast doing it. It was just fun.
It's got to be a little liberating.
Yeah.
To just
do whatever.
Do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Not chasing somebody around.
Yeah. Of course, nobody was paying me to do it. That's, you know.
That's a little bit different too, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about music because, you know, anybody that follows you on Instagram or Twitter or what have you are going to see photos, some beautiful photos of musicians. You posted a great photo of Tom Petty when he passed away. So did you do a lot of photography of musicians before you landed in the White House?
Yeah, I don't know if I did a lot. I mean, one of the things that was great about being a newspaper photographer, which I did for, 13 years of my career, is you get a variety of assignments. And, and that included oftentimes, concerts or musicians. And I always, I always enjoyed that. And then the Obama White House made a concerted effort to bring in music and musicians from all genres to the White House. So, that was also...
That had to be fun.
Really fun. You know, along the way, I struck up a friendship with Brandi Carlile, who's a singer-songwriter in Seattle. Became pretty good friends with her and have been... doing some photographs of her. Her new record just came out last week, and so there's some of my pictures are included in the packaging. But I've also tried to have become acquaintances of the Lumineers, and they happened to be in Italy when I was in Italy, so they hosted me and my wife for one of their concerts. I was never a Fish fan, the band Fish, but just by sheer coincidence, the co-manager of Fish is also the co-manager of Brandi Carlile. So, I called up Patrick and said they had this 13-night run at Madison Square Garden. So
right.
I said, "All right, I gotta come and check it out." So he got me in with a photo pass and. Took me all around during the show, and I experienced that, which was, now I sort of, I get the, it's sort of like they're the Grateful Dead for the current generation. And, the thing that was amazing to me is they played 13 nights in Madison Square Garden, and in those 13 nights, they never repeated a song. That's impressive.
It is impressive.
Yeah.
Bruce Springsteen, you're a fan, right?
Big, huge fan of Springsteen. I mean, I've probably been to 40 of his shows over the years, starting in 1978, and when I had to sneak in a camera to take some pictures of him. I've gotten to know him a little bit just because he has become friends with the Obamas. And so he was... not around a lot, but enough where, every once in a while I'd get to chat briefly with him. And I just admire, the things he's done in his career. It's been fun seeing him up close and getting to know him a little bit.
And that's there's a great photo in your book of Bono.
Yeah.
He was visiting the president at the White House. That was pretty fun.
Yeah, so the president had invited him and Alicia Keys for lunch. I forget the circumstance. And so Bono walks into the, there's a little dining room right off the Oval Office. And Bono walks in and says, "Where should I sit?" And the president's like, "Wherever there's a chair." And Bono, it's funny to see how somebody's mind works. There happened to be a guitar case in the corner of the dining room that President Obama had gotten during the campaign. And Bono pulled it out. It had never been played, never been tuned. And he, like, quickly tuned it. And then he starts singing Norwegian Wood by the Beatles because there's a line in there about, "I promised to find her a chair," or something like that. Like, how that... How he, like, just came up on that, the spur of the moment, it was really pretty amazing. So he's playing the song, and the president's, like, kind of looking back at me, saying, like, "How cool is this?" You know.
That is pretty cool. Another moment that you captured in your book that I do love is when Paul McCartney sang "Michelle" to Michelle Obama, but the president's response to that was...
Yeah, I mean, this was... So Paul McCartney had gotten a Gershwin Prize, which they awarded at the White House. And there were other artists that sang songs on stage. But then for the finale, McCartney himself went up and played "Hey Jude," "Let It Be," and then "Michelle" to, you know, Michelle. While it was happening, I was thinking to myself, this is really kind of cool, right? And then the next day, I was we had some event and we're walking back to the Oval Office from the state floor. And I said to the president that, "Hey, that was a pretty cool event last night." And he said something to me like, "Yeah, I don't think Michelle Obama, growing up as a young African-American girl on the south side of Chicago, thought that someday she'd be sitting in the front row of the White House as the first lady listening to a former Beatle sing her namesake song." And my mouth just kind of dropped open like, wow. I mean, he really put it in perspective, you know.
Many thanks to Pete Souza for talking with me. The Essential Conversation series is a production of Detroit's public radio station, WDET. If you enjoyed it, I hope you'll listen to other episodes in this series. Production provided by Rowan Nemisto and original music by Brett Lucas. I'm Ann DeLisi. Thanks so much for listening.